It's all good. I found out where Sarah's desk is. Maybe. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. Joining me today is Sarah Cliff. Ezra is on vacation, and we have a great show. We got a good white paper about education for you guys. I'm going to talk a little bit about single-payer healthcare and some of the sort of policy work on that side. But obviously, I think the big news story of the past week has been Hurricane Harvey and the incredible flooding in Houston and environs. And you know, it's not a political story, obviously, weather happens. But there are a lot of policy issues sort of in play here whenever you see not just disaster response, but how we got here. And with Houston, it's particularly sort of telling because the federal flood insurance program was actually set to expire soon. And so Congress was going to have a debate about the subject of federal programs to help people live in flood-prone areas. And now we have a big kind of stark, you know, this is typically a very obscure program, but we've all been watching a lot of flood.
I've learned a lot about flood insurance in the past few weeks.
So it's been for the sort of weeds mentality, a convenient confluence of a kind of interesting, you know, policy topic with a horrifying human disaster. But I guess the basics of this are that the private sector does not want to sell people homeowners insurance that protects them against flood damage, because flood damage is sort of more like health insurance than like insurance against your house burning down, in that like it's quite predictable which houses are going to flood. And so it's like nobody wants to sell you an insurance policy you would want to buy. So the federal government created this program to like create a large risk pool. It seems like the program is not actuarially sound, so it receives some federal subsidy, which is fine. We subsidize lots of things at the federal level. But in this case, what we are subsidizing is living in a house that is likely to be destroyed by a flood, which seems weird.
One of the really crazy things to me reading about this program, the National Flood Insurance Program's history, which began in the 1960s, and Mike Grunwald of Politico wrote a nice history of, is that it was actually meant to deter development in risky areas. It was meant to say, you know, this is a risky area. You're going to have to buy an insurance policy to build there. But it seems to have, you know, done the exact opposite, that you've had this massive underestimation of risk. And, you know, to draw the health comparison that Matt was making, you know, when you have a population full of people who you know have, let's say, hemophilia, a really expensive disease for care for, you would charge incredibly high premiums because you know those drugs are just really expensive. And you haven't seen the same thing develop in these high-risk areas that are flooding very repeatedly. One of the things I found really interesting in that Grunwald story in Politico, which I would recommend, is that there was a report particular to Houston about 20 years ago where they were making the case that Houston has had the most urban flooding in the past four decades than any other area, that this is a place that just has constantly been flooding, which suggested evidence that this program was not charging nearly enough for the premiums in the Houston area, that it was underestimating the amount of floods because it's using data from the past and not keeping up with the actual risks we know about the most recently. And Houston, in a way, it was very unpredictable, and it's been a very unpredictable week with a lot of people dealing with some really huge, massive problems and dealing with, you know, losing their houses. But in another way, it was a quite predictable problem from everything we know about Houston. ProPublica did an amazing investigation about a year ago on Houston in particular and how it has been allowing people to build more homes in floodplains, that there really hasn't been much attention paid to the flood risks as the city has developed. So it's both been a very chaotic, unpredictable week, but Houston is a city that has been at risk for a while. And the National Flood Insurance Program has really been one that has enabled that, that has allowed that development to continue. Right now, I think it's about 24 $1 billion in debt, and it has a limit of $30 billion. It has permission from the federal government to borrow $30 billion. And this is where we end up with one of those deadlines where the Congress is going to need to extend that borrowing limit in possibly more rapid order to make up this shortfall that is going to increase with Hurricane Harvey. And it's just, it's a predictable and kind of sad situation that policy certainly helped play a role in and certainly kind of led to some of the things that we're seeing play out in Houston right now.
Yeah, and I mean, the story I was told talking to some people who worked on economic policy in the Obama administration and were sort of charged with administering this program, although they were not like flood guys, but it falls under Treasury's bailiwick. You know, and the way they described it to me was that at least pre-Trump, right, classically, the Democratic Party had its sort of dominant areas, and there were the deep red areas. And then there was contested terrain that involved a lot of, you know, winnable but more culturally conservative terrain. And you would have Democratic senators from places like Louisiana and Iowa, you know, at times. And that this was a kind of fulcrum point constituency that, you know, those states, particularly Louisiana, where there's a lot of flooding, were like the people who were always, yeah, you should keep doing this flood insurance program. And critically, that the representatives from the flood-prone areas liked that the program was actuarially unsound, right? Because you can cast different people as the victims and the perpetrators here. But, you know, it was that in flood-prone areas, the political sort of establishment liked the fact that the premiums were too low because that encouraged economic development. And then they would go back and ask for more money through this debt mechanism. It's hard to look at people in Houston, you know, with like people dead, people's homes destroyed, people's suffering enormous loss and say like, aha, these lucky duckies, they got their unfairly cheap flood insurance premium, right? I mean, it seems like you're actually creating victims, but it was the sort of politicians of these areas who didn't want to just sort of accept the market verdict that or the data verdict, if you're going to have it as a government program, that like, look, it may seem like the city of Houston is surrounded by this cheap, abundant land that you should build lots and lots of houses on, but like actually that land has enormous hidden flooding risks, and so it should be expensive to build in the suburbs of Houston. Not necessarily so expensive that nothing is put there, but Houston has been one of the fastest growing metro areas for a long time now. It's become the fourth or fifth biggest metro area. And that's because it's been perceived by developers as like a great place to throw up relatively cheap houses. But the only reason that that works is that this flood risk has not been kind of priced appropriately. Something that's interesting to me is that everybody seems to agree that that's the basic dynamic. But then people have thrown on top of that a lot of criticisms of Houston's zoning and land use rules, which seems to me to be redundant. Right. I mean, to say, well, the problem in Houston is that they weren't strict enough about their zoning and they left too much up to the free market. But also the problem in Houston is there was a massive federal program to subsidize building in flood prone areas. Like they didn't leave it up to the free market. Like maybe they should have, or maybe they should have countervailing public programs where on the one hand, the federal government subsidizes building in floodplains, but then local governments prohibit building in floodplains. But that's like, that to me is like a conservative's caricature of how liberals think about public policy, that like everything has to be simultaneously subsidized and banned. But that actually, like, stepping back from this flood insurance thing, it's like true that the private sector does not want people to build homes on like flat, flood-prone land adjacent to like giant low bank rivers. To push the analogy in the healthcare sector, right? We say like, well, this is the whole problem, right? Because like the insurance companies, they're good at predicting the risk, but we don't want them to predict the risk. We don't want them to make it impossible for hemophiliacs to get medical care, because although there's a certain amount of moral hazard involved in, you know, the government taking care of sick people, I think we're all skeptical that anyone is like out there deliberately getting cancer, like just because the financial downside isn't that bad, because like it sucks to be sick. Whereas people will totally like make unsound housing development decisions if you cover their risk, right? I mean, it's like bank bailouts, except for, you know, subdivision developers.
Well, there was one crazy example. The Pew Foundation did a study of the flood flood program, and they looked at these outlier, these houses that are multiple floods, that have flooded multiple times. They live in flood insurance areas. And these are about 1% of houses that have flood insurance. They make up 10% of claims. And one example they had that was just astounding was they said there's one $69,000 home in Mississippi that has flooded 34 times in 32 years and has so far received $663,000 in payments. So, of course, you know, if you have that kind of backstop, like, why not build a $69,000 house in this, like, flood zone in Mississippi? And I do think one of the things that is challenging the program, you know, the thing you need in any sort of insurance program is a good estimation of risk. You need to be spreading out the risk among a wider group of people so that in some years, you know, if there's a flood in Houston and all these people who have flood insurance elsewhere didn't have a flood, their premiums are covering it. And, you know, in another year, there's a flood in Mississippi and then the premiums go there. You could have a reasonable flood insurance program that kind of got those risks right, that looked at, you know, one of the things they do is look at areas that are a 100-year flood zone, meaning that in one of 100 years, you'd expect there to be a flood or a 500-year flood zone, and setting the risk appropriate to the amount of floods you expect. One of the things we've seen both with, and Brian Resnick here has been doing some good reporting on this, both with more urban development, which kind of just leaves less place for water to go when water falls on concrete, when water falls on, you know, streets, it does not have as much of a place to go as when it falls into a wetland. So that's certainly one of the things going on, again, with Houston's big development and big urban sprawl, and with climate change making storms, you know, stronger. Those risk factors are changing significantly, but the federal formulas that determine risk are not keeping up. So you could, it seems like the thing to do rather than having a federal policy that encourages building in flood zones and a local policy that pushes back against that federal policy is calibrating the policy to do the thing you want it to do. You know, we changed our health insurance system because we wanted it to be a health insurance system that was willing to cover risky people. So we said, you can't deny risky people. And insurance companies, very smartly, they raise their premiums as a result, saying, well, you know, we're going to have to take these hemophiliacs and cancer patients. We are going to have to raise our prices. And a flood insurance market, I don't think, is super different. Like, we could decide this was a national priority and decide that, like, Matt and I here in DC have to pay some kind of flood insurance premium, even though we're super low risk, just because there are more floods happening and you need more low-risk people in the pool, that you have a very high-risk insurance pool right now. But I think one of the things that's really hard in housing policy is making these changes when people have made some really long-term purchases, you know, based on what policy was like when they bought their house. Right. Probably the biggest purchase they will ever make in their life, a long-term purchase that's going to stick with them with their mortgage, often makes changing these sorts of things very difficult. If you were to all of a sudden assess all the houses in Houston a flood insurance premium that reflected the actual risk of flood, it'd become much, much more expensive to live in Houston. And maybe that's the outcome we want. But like you said, the politics of that are challenging and the human cost of that is challenging. Like, I have sympathy for people who went in thinking their insurance premium was one thing and then all of a sudden it's going to skyrocket and they have this mortgage and no one's going to want to buy that house with the huge increase in the insurance premium.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, though, that what we should look at doing is cutting off this kind of subsidized flood insurance for new building, right? That there's been big sort of population movement toward the Sun Belt, which, you know, there's some fundamental drivers for, but it's in some ways been a socially disruptive kind of thing, right? You have a lot of Rust Belt cities that are over-provisioned with infrastructure and suffering from population decline. Houston's had incredible sprawl. I mean, you know, people should move if they want to. Texas is nice. Some people like the weather in the Houston area. I find it a little hot. But, you know, it's fine if people want to go there. But, you know, I've been to the Netherlands and talked to people there about climate change and flooding. And obviously, the Dutch have made it a priority. national priority that people should be able to live in places where, left to their own devices, they will be flooded out. And that's because that's like basically their whole country more or less fits that description. Some places more, some places less. But it's like a question of national survival to the Dutch is that people should be able to like live below sea level in coastal areas. They have vast dams. They're very worried about climate change, but they're also going to invest in the technology. America, you know, happens to be blessed with a fairly vast internal landscape. There's no particular reason that people need to live in flood-prone areas. And, you know, the genesis of this program seems to be that, well, we used to not have a program, but still people were living in flood-prone areas. So there were these kind of irregular bailouts. The South used to be extremely poor relative to the rest of the country, so it was sort of sympathetic cases around the Mississippi River. But fundamentally, while we have in some parts of the United States sort of acute housing shortages, we're not short just in principle on like some land where there could be a house. I mean, it's basically a huge federal program to subsidize building in flood-prone areas. And I just don't see like why you would, if you put it that way, nobody would do it. So they'd like maintain this fiction that, well, it has a debt and, oh, we need to let it borrow some more money. But like, they're pretty clearly not going to, the flood insurance program is not going to pay back that money anytime soon. Nobody is saying like, well, we're going to raise premiums so much that it's going to become like a profit center and start kicking money back to the treasury. And if you propose like, well, let's have an explicit subsidy to build houses in places where it's dangerous, like that sounds a little nutty. I mean, in some ways, the miracle of this is that it looks like they do a pretty good job actually of rescuing and evacuating all these people. I mean, it's an unbelievably large city, and obviously the dislocation and the property damage and stuff is terrible, but I think it looks like a fairly impressive, you know, response and mobilization, but almost like too much complacency in the United States about the idea that like the most crazy, horrible things can happen. And then like a flotilla of people in small boats is going to go rescue everyone, which is, it's inspiring, but also like not a great way to live.
Right. Like we've become much better at our immediate disaster response, but then like the long-term planning, you know, around like, well, how do we want to deal with this the next time seems to be the place where it's lacking. In an insurance program, it does not have to be one that subsidizes living in flood-prone areas. It could be, you know, you could reform an insurance program that makes it quite expensive or lets, you know, some kind of private, I think it is a strong signal that private plans do not want to cover this sort of thing because it is so predictable. And I think that is a signal to why this program is in debt and the struggles that it faces. In a weird way, it actually reminds me of part of the Affordable Care Act that they had to kill. It was this long-term insurance program, the CLASS Act. I forget what it stands for at this point because it was eons ago. But this was kind of the hobby horse of Ted Kennedy. He really wanted a long-term care program because you have a lot of people who, you know, more and more people needing nursing care. And so they included this voluntary long-term care insurance plan that you could sign up for and you could get covered for the kind of long-term nursing rehabilitative care that more and more Americans as they get older end up needing. And this program, it had this tiny little clause in there that said, you know, if the federal government does not think they can implement this in an actuarially sound way, then they need to scrap it. You can't actually move forward. And the Obama administration ended up scrapping it, which was kind of a surprising turn from an administration that was obviously quite supportive of the law. They basically said there's no way to run a voluntary insurance program because the premiums are just going to be sky high. Now, you could have done something like the National Flood Insurance Program where you just said, well, it can just go into debt and, you know, we'll set the premiums at a rate that we think is reasonable and fair. But you saw in the CLASS Act program, it was decided, you know, we can't run a program where everyone is high risk. It's going to go into debt that is not affordable. And the Obama administration never implemented that part of the Affordable Care Act. It remains unimplemented today. And it seems like the National Flood Insurance Program has gone down a very alternate route where they decided to implement an insurance program with a lot of high risk people and just let it go into significant debt. I think one of the political challenges around this is you'd expect the people to oppose that would be conservatives who say, you know, this government program, it's not working. You can imagine if, you know, that class act had gone into effect, there'd be huge outcry about the fact it was in debt, it wasn't paying its bills. But a lot of people who tend to be those budget hawks are also representing the areas that are benefiting from the National Flood Insurance Program. And I don't think, I haven't seen much, well, you've talked to the wrong people, so maybe you have thoughts on this, but I don't know that there's much liberal appetite to reform it either.
I sort of think that's the main thing. I mean, this is the kind of thing that conservatives will sometimes take, you know, think tanky type conservatives are very sort of jazzed up about, like, this is a bad idea, right? This is a great example of, like, big government having perverse consequences. And different members of Congress will pop up to oppose it at one time or another. But this is the kind of thing where Democratic members of Congress sort of not really caring about things becomes very helpful to them. Like, they will take the side of coastal communities and wannabe home builders, you know, in a fight against pure free market ideology, sort of anytime they're given it. And there's a bunch of random programs like this. Like, there's a program to subsidize airports in, like, really small communities where they're not commercially viable. And you might think, it's like, well, why would Democrats go to bat for this? Like, it's environmentally horrible. It doesn't, like, help Democrats' constituents, but it's, like, a great, like, little wedge issue to, like, try to help Democrats in rural areas that big city ones have their backs on. I think it's telling that Jeb Hensarling, who chairs Financial Services Committee in the House, he's a critic of the flood insurance program, as you would expect a free marketer to be. But he's not like, quite willing to just say, like, this is dumb, we shouldn't do this, or we should sunset it. He wants to say, well, we could create this, like, alternate mechanism with private insurance that's somehow subsidized, kind of like create, like, Obamacare for flooding disasters instead of single-payer flooding disasters. And I have not looked into it in detail. Like, I don't know if his plan, like, will work or not. But it's the kind of slightly paradoxical situation where it would almost be better if it didn't work, right? Like, it seems to me, I mean, unlike delivering medical care to sick people, while it's, of course, good to help people whose homes have just been destroyed by a flood, the moral hazard problem with the flood insurance is, like, it's quite real, you know? And, like, really, this is an activity we should be discouraging people from doing. And having an effective private sector insurance program, a public sector one, it's actually not like, a reasonable approach to things. There's no public interest in having so many people live in flood-prone areas, right? And that, to me, is the difference, but it's sort of like politically, it's like, it's toxic, right? Like, you can't just show up in people's houses and be like, your community shouldn't be here, and which I totally get, right? I mean, I'm not an idiot. And yet, that's the fact. I mean, particularly with these 1% of houses, right? I mean, houses that are multiple times in the span of an authorization period being destroyed by floods and need to be rebuilt, like, that's like, don't put a house there, you know? Like, America is not out of space to have houses. We should put them places that they're safe. And people want that on the regulatory side. So I don't know. I mean, it's to me a frustrating situation. Although in some ways it's like the refreshing normalcy of Congress, where, like, interest group politics and short-sightedness are carrying the day rather than any kind of, like, maniacal ideological agenda.
Right, because these are events, while they are happening more frequently, they also are somewhat unpredictable. So it feels similar to climate change policy in that a lot of it feels very distant future, that we don't know when the next flood will be in Houston. You know, we can build a house right now and the risks are kind of, they're more certain, but they still feel uncertain at the time of building things. So a lot of the consequences get pushed off into the future. You know, the market that might make sense, although it's going to be one that would disadvantage the people who live in flood areas, is going to some sort of pre-Obamacare individual market for flood insurance. But again, that's one that's really hard to attract private insurers to it. But in that market, you'd be charged for the amount of risk that you bring to the market, the amount of, so that, you know, $69,000 home that I mentioned in Mississippi, the one that's flooded 34 times in 32 years, would probably have to pay a very, very high premium if any private company would insure it at all. But I think the thing that's different is there's at least some level of choice involved in living in that house in Mississippi in a way that is not as true with most healthcare conditions. But, you know, at the same time, I am sympathetic. You're talking in a lot of cases about a lower income population with like less mobility, less ability, you know, to move somewhere that isn't that house in Mississippi, to start somewhere new. So I think it's a tough problem. And I'm sympathetic to the fact that we're suggesting here in DC, you know, well, just move to somewhere that isn't as flood prone, you know, migrate north to Wisconsin, or actually Wisconsin's at flooding. That's not a good example. Oklahoma, I'm guessing, doesn't have
a lot
of flooding.
You just live further from the river. I mean, you can still live in Texas.
Yeah, but moving houses, like all those mobility issues, I think those are a challenge when you have gone down this path that make it a hard thing to solve.
Yeah.
Speaking of other paths we have gone down. That make hard challenges.
Can we talk about healthcare, Sarah, for once?
Yeah.
Damn it.
I'm ready to. I went on vacation and I'm rested and excited to talk about healthcare.
Tanned, rested, and ready. Okay, so healthcare. I don't know. So
you wrote this piece this week, Matt.
Yeah. So I did a piece because this is sort of about just my puzzlement. But like I'm not really a healthcare person. This podcast notwithstanding, but I talk to people, and you know, for years, I have rarely heard a Democrat, you know, someone who would have voted for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, who is a health policy expert. I've rarely heard them like turn with the like full bore shotgun level, like single payer healthcare is a terrible idea. The Affordable Care Act represents a far superior approach to Medicare for all, so superior that once it's in place, what we really ought to do is like scrap Medicare and put all these old people into this glorious system of private sector choice. I'm sure somebody thinks that, but that's not normally like the answer that people get. And I show in my piece, you know, everyone from Nancy Pelosi to Barack Obama to Kathleen Sebelius, who was Obama's HHS secretary, they all say at one time or another, like, well, you know, if I was starting from scratch, like, I think it might actually make more sense to have a government-run system. But they have politically, whatever, you know, they don't think it's feasible. They don't think it's the most practical thing to be focused on. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I get it. I especially get people who in the 2016 campaign thought it was counterproductive of Bernie Sanders to be like sort of running down this like big achievement, and that they wanted the focus to be on defending Obamacare, winning the election, tweaking it to improve it so people like it better. I get it, like as a political strategy. It makes sense to me. That said, I'm also just a journalist. I can see that there is a lot of people who want the Democratic Party to push for a single-payer healthcare bill, right? It's not anymore, if it ever was. There used to be like six cranks who would show up at every event and talk about this, but it's like multiple United States senators. It's most of the state legislators in New York and in California. It's a guy who got 40% of the vote in the primary. Like, people would like to do this. And it strikes me that the sort of wonk class is jumping its lane and deciding that they have this theory that Bernie Sanders' theory of politics is wrong, and so they're going to like abstain from any participation in this. And in part as a result of that, the actual specific single-payer plans that like John Conyers has in the House of Representatives, that they had out in California, I believe the New York bill, are really pretty sloppy and don't really make a ton of sense. And I would really like to see some people who, whether or not they like think this is politically realistic, to just engage with the fact that many people in the grassroots, many activists, many elected officials would like to push for a single-payer healthcare program and like do the work of helping to like map one out that could actually work and that answers some of these lingering questions about how do you handle a transition? Like, what kind of taxes could pay for it? How would you set payments? I think Physicians for a National Healthcare Plan have come closest to this of anybody. in terms of detailing options, although their tendency every time there's like a tough choice between a few different options is to say, well, here's a few different options. So like that's something that they have at least thought about, like, how is this going to look? But, you know, normally in advance of anything getting done, you have, it's not that like candidates necessarily need to like lead with their chin as like, here's my multi-trillion dollar tax increase. But somebody's got to like do the work on this. And none of the, you know, usual think tanks that I go to have anything like a, you know, here's our plan to transition America to Medicare for all over time, or, you know, anything more moderate, more ambitious, like nothing at all. And it seems to me at this point to be actually quite counterproductive. If you like a good massage, and frankly, who doesn't, but you don't have the time or the energy to go to a spa, you got to check out Zeal, where you can book a 5-star top quality massage in the comfort of your own home. You just go to Zeal.com or their iPhone or Android app. That's Zeal, spelled Zeel.com. And you can select from top local licensed and pre-screened massage therapists. You choose your favorite technique, gender preference, time, and location for your massage. 7 days a week, 365 days a year, a Zeal massage therapist can be at your door in as little as an hour. Privacy, convenience, quality, and comfort. That's what you get with your massage on demand with Zeal. They'll send one of their 9,000 licensed massage therapists for the massage table, music, and everything you need to turn your living room into a spa, give you a 5-star massage. Scheduling, booking, and payment is easy. Even the tip is included, so there's no cash changing hands. You don't need to wait all week for a massage appointment at a spa. Zeal can come right to you right away. So find out for yourself why Zeal's been featured in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Vogue, and Good Morning America, because you can bring the spa to you and try Zeal today, like literally today. They are on demand. You can just like stop listening to the podcast right now, check it out, come back, listen to us more when you're more relaxed. Get the best massage of your life in your own home with Zeal today. So to help you get started, our listeners can get $25 off their first massage using promo code THEWEEDS at checkout. Gets better, sign up for Zeal's massage membership. You get 20% off all your massages, plus a free massage table and a sheet set. It's a $380 value, and it's yours for free. There's no initiation fee to join the membership, just a great additional savings on top of the $25 discount you're going to get when you use promo code THEWEEDS. So go to Zeel, Zeel.com, or use their iPhone or Android app, and then make sure to click add promo code at checkout to use the code THEWEEDS. Get $25 off your first in-home on-demand massage.
I think you're exactly right that a lot of the left think tanks are not working on this in any real way. And I think it is still very true that that energy is being sucked up by plans to fix the Affordable Care Act. Right now, we're coming up next week. We're going to have bipartisan hearings on the Hill in the Senate about health law stabilization. And a lot of the energy, you know, a lot of the reports I see coming out of liberal think tanks like Center for American Progress, Urban Institute, are really focused on that. Like, that is where they have their health teams right now, is working on these plans to stabilize the individual market, dealing with things like how do you reinsure the market? How do you structure the open enrollment period? You know, restoring these cost-sharing subsidies we've talked about before. A lot, it seems to me, among, like, the health wonk class that I talk to, they feel very much like our job right now is to support this law that we passed, that it still needs help, it still needs more policy. So all the things I see coming out are very much in that space of the tweaks that were coming up during the election. And I think there is kind of a hesitance among health wonks who are still, I think, like you said, in their heart of hearts, like, think single payer is a good system, but are still skeptical of the idea that we could actually transition to that kind of system in the United States, who see it as a good system, but kind of look at it's a little chicken and egg, right? Because they look at the plans that are out there and they say, well, that's not realistic, but they don't really, they're kind of the ones who would come up with the realistic plan eventually. And I think that's the place where things are a little bit stuck, you know, but we have seen some of this work before. You know, when Vermont was working on its single player plan in, that was like 2014 or so, They retained this guy at Harvard, William Shao, who's worked with a lot of countries that have transitioned to single payer systems. And they basically brought him on to work through, well, how can we do a state level one? It didn't eventually work. They ultimately failed. They couldn't really, the financing turned out to be the difficult part. And I think that's actually where I see the biggest gaps in the wonk space right now. And you mentioned this a little bit in your piece, is I think it's not that it's, I don't want to say it's not hard, but I think the easier part is designing a healthcare system, is saying, you know, we're going to have like a single payer or multi-payer, you know, here's what our universal system looks like. Here's what kind of coverage benefits you have. Here's who makes the decisions on what's covered. That's hard. But I think the harder thing is figuring out, how are we going to pay for this? And right now you see a lot of either single payer or universal coverage plans that essentially skirt that challenge. I think you said, you know, I wrote last week about Senator Brian Schatz from Hawaii, his Medicaid buy-in bill, which doesn't really, you know, the summaries we've been given so far say the financing is something that's going to be dealt with later. I think you read about the Conyers bill that it says there will be some tax increases that are unspecified. I think that's always where the rubber hits the road with these healthcare plans and where, you know, you see the key decisions being made. And it's also, it's what leaves plans a lot more vulnerable to attack. And I think that's one thing that holds a lot of folks back, is when you lay the choices of a single payer system bare, they're difficult choices. Like, we're talking about big tax increases. We're probably talking about a significant cut to doctor salaries if it's going [S2] Right. [S1] To be affordable. Like, I think that holds people back. And I think we see the folly of this method, but they look at Trump, who just spent like a campaign saying, well, it's going to be cheaper and better and it's great. And I think there is some thought like, well, why should we put our plans out there to be attacked when you can get elected just making these vague promises?
Well, I mean, I completely understand. To be clear, like, I'm not necessarily saying that, like, what John Conyers needs to do is, like, be more honest and clear about the scale of the tax increases that John Conyers' plan would require. But I also think that it's unproductive to have the only people who are running the math on Conyers' bill be people who hate it. You know what I mean? Because the truth is, something like what he wants to do, which is to pretty suddenly transition everyone into not even Medicare, but a much more generous, no deductible system, that would be very expensive. It would require a large tax increase. That said, the United States is already spending a lot of money on healthcare. Shifting the spending from private to public is not, in principle, a nutty idea. I agree. I think politically it's a hard sell. I don't really think it would work. That said, I don't think it's a terrible idea. And to have Conyers be vague and then, like, the Heritage Foundation do the math with, like, the most pessimistic possible assumptions and be like, this is going to cost $20 trillion. And then nobody on the left, nobody who's sympathetic to the goal, being like, here's a idea that would provide very generous, high-quality health insurance to every American in a fair way. It is modeled on, you know, what Canada does. And to pay for it, we would need to do the, you know, just like in a straightforward way. And then to say, like, this would be a big change in people's lives, but that you would be relieved from all these different costs and, like, work it out, you know, in, like, a way that is credible but hopeful about the functionality of these things, which is how you build support for policy ideas in general, right? Now, does that mean something like the Conyers bill is ever going to happen? I'm skeptical. My guess is that John Conyers is skeptical. Like a lot of things that happen in the policy world, it's like you start with a given proposal and you end up with something else happening. I think that realistically what you need to do is more directly capture all the money that employers are currently spending on insurance premiums and, like, use that money to pay for healthcare services. So that's probably some kind of buy-in program, something like that. But at least if you have a sense of, like, this is what we would like to do, and this is what would be involved, and this is what it would cost, and here are some ways you could raise that money, you then have a situation where you could do parts of it, or you could do, you know, phased-in transitions or things like that. Whereas right now, with everyone kind of being like, well, that's unrealistic, you know, here's a plan to do reinsurance in Iowa, you're missing a lot. And in particular, the fact is that, you know, the Affordable Care Act has had a lot of successes. But the vision that the exchanges would be so good that they would become, like, the model going forward has, I think, really failed. You know, and that's something that I think some of the people behind Obamacare have not really acknowledged, right? But there was one aspiration. I mean, different people involved had different hopes, but I think there was one aspiration that was like, look, these exchanges are going to come. They're going to be great, right? People are going to really love the fact that they can choose from three or four different insurance companies that are offering affordable plans. And over time, states are going to apply for waivers so that employers can buy into exchanges. People are going to transition. We're going to break the link between employment and healthcare. And it's now looking really clear, like none of that is going to happen, right? At best case scenario, a lot of people are going to be sort of given a subsidy check from the government to go buy insurance from one insurance company who's the only one who's there in their marketplace, who's only serving that market because there's no competition and because their customers are subsidized. And fair enough, right? It's way better to get a subsidy check from the government to buy insurance from a monopoly insurer than to have no health insurance. But, like, why? Like, why create that system? Like, what are the virtues of the emerging ACA exchange system that would make you say that this is a good idea? This is how people should be getting their insurance. Because if there's no... if outside of the biggest cities, there's no meaningful insurer competition, then, like, what's this for?
So I'll stand up for the people working on reinsurance in Iowa, because I think it is still a fair use of, like, health policy energy. We're in a situation where, you know, I think it is realistic to recognize that President Trump is not going to enact any kind of healthcare legislation, any significance kind of single-payer plan. And you have millions of people relying on these kind of faltering markets for health insurance. And so I think there's been a decision made, and I don't really quibble with it among liberal wonks, to say we need to focus on what we can do with this healthcare system we have right now, that we need to look at the problems and figure out some kind of way and do it in a bipartisan way. So you see these kind of groups forming with really weird bedfellows releasing these recommendations for how to stabilize the ACA. And I think a lot of that energy is going, instead of kind of building out single-payer systems, to figuring out in the exact opposite direction of, like, where can we build common ground with conservatives to rescue this part of the Affordable Care Act a little bit and put it on firmer footing? Because I think it is certainly true, like, this is the healthcare system we have for the next few years, and it needs some kind of help. And I do think, even though I agree with, you know, your point, Matt, that we need more optimistic, like, thoughts on single payer, more plans that kind of look at this generously and think through, like, how can we build a system that works? There's also a decent amount of policy innovation, I think, happening in both the Senate and state legislatures right now around, well, what do we even want this to look like? Like, the Medicaid buy-in, I think, is a really good example that we saw. The Sprinkle Care we talked about earlier, where Nevada tried to do a program where anyone could buy into Medicaid. Senator Schatz from Hawaii introduced a version of that into the Senate last week. I think we're expecting a few other proposals. We're expecting Bernie's single-payer plan to come out sometime, I think, in about the next month or so. So I think, you know, the early part of policymaking is kind of talking through more in theory, what you want your plan to do, how you want it to work. And I feel like I see that happening on the Senate side. You know, one of the things when Jeff Stein and I interviewed Senator Schatz, his argument was like, let's put these bills through hearings. Like, let's actually have hearings on these bills. You know, he's signing on as a co-sponsor to single-payer bills, but also says he prefers his Medicaid for all bill. I think there's a lot of energy and different ideas being introduced, and that the contents of those will likely... the question, like, hanging out there is, like, do the contents of those get fleshed out enough to become actual plans? But I think, you know, now feels like an appropriate moment for thinking about, well, what comes next? We have this, like, right, 3-year period where Trump is going to be president, unless something happens, and who knows what can happen. And in that period, there's a lot of thinking on what is the structure, like, what does the healthcare system that we want to build actually look like? And I do see evidence of that kind of thinking happening.
I mean, maybe I'm just old-fashioned, but, you know, I remember in the early days of the 21st century that it was, you know, New America Foundation, I think, first laid out an idea for mandatory health insurance with some kind of subsidization, right? And that was building on work that had come from the Heritage Foundation as a counterproposal to Bill Clinton's idea. It got knocked around in Massachusetts. There was a big then Health Affairs article that John Podesta, Jean Lambrew, and a third co-author, whose name I'm forgetting, did, but that was saying, this isn't actually what Obamacare wound up doing, but it was basically the federal employee health benefits program should be extended, was their version of the exchanges. And, you know, none of these people were elected officials, but the arc of elected officials' thinking, like, eventually bent toward these kind of plans that experts had been outlining for years, you know, kind of like doing the legwork for some way to subsidize people getting into private health insurance was the big idea. Whereas now I feel like the process has become almost inverted, right? Like people talk on podcasts about like, well, maybe anyone should be able to get Medicaid. And then like some state legislators are like, that's a good idea. And now like, there's like a U.S. senator kind of version of that. And so like maybe at some point before Brian Johnson's bill becomes law, someone with like a PhD will actually take a look at this idea and see if it works. Obviously, I love podcasts, but I do believe that like the community of policy experts should be attempting to like lead and map out options in a little bit less of an aggressive way than like hot take artists and digital media, but more aggressive than politicians would. On some level, Democrats are just like so still shell-shocked about this whole Donald Trump thing that they're not like internalizing the like natural process of you lose power, you like stop tinkering around the edges with the programs that you're wedded to because it's what you could get through Congress. And you like open up your blue sky notebook and you're like, here's what we want to do to solve the American people's big problems. And then, you know, eventually, like you got to work out campaign slogans, you got to try to win races, you got to try to like get bills done through the grinder of the legislative process. But there's supposed to be like a moment in that step. And this is where, you know, this is what I think a lot of people have enjoyed about Bernie Sanders, is just where you like step back and you're like, how should the world work, you know? But that could use a little more filling in by people who are not going to just be like, well, every industrialized country has a healthcare system like that, because like that is not true. And like, what do we really need to do? Because it would be a shame if, you know, the resistance to Trump is incredibly successful, like beyond its wildest bounds, and like sweeps to huge election wins in the next 3.5 years, and then has like nothing but these kind of like half-assed plans that are like pay for TK. And then they do, I mean, you get this Trump care situation where everyone's like, well, it'll be smarter politically to not talk about that stuff. And then when you're passing the bill, you're like, oh shit, like we're going to need a giant tax hike, right? It's not, because you can just get nothing done that way, right? Like you've really seen it. I don't want to say that like the path of honesty and goodness is always most effective, but it is definitely true that you cannot. We saw with Donald Trump, I think we've seen it time and again, you can't like fundamentally reshape things that are important to people's lives like just by bullshitting about it. Like you're going to have to come up with something that members feel comfortable like actually defending to people. And right now, it's like it's really not there.
So I think the key kind of like moment to watch will be early 2018 when we've gotten through Obamacare, open enrollment, if there's going to be any kind of stabilization legislation, that it will have passed, it will have failed, that window will have sunset. And then you're in a scenario where the ACA is, you know, kind of hanging out for the next year, likely no big policy changes. And I think the thing I watch for is whether health policy attention on the left turns to single payer, bigger blue sky ideas, or if it heads somewhere else. And I don't exactly, I guess the somewhere else would be sticking with these small Obamacare tweaks. I think 3.5 years is still a lot of time to work through policy ideas, to think through how would a Medicaid expansion work. In a way, I see a lot of these different Senate bills or House bills as a possible starting point. Although I think you're right, Matt, the kind of test is whether these receive a very critical reading from the left, or if they receive a more generous reading. I remember, I think it was Urban Institute during the 2016 election that put out the study that was quite critical of the Sanders plan, basically saying that the Sanders plan would cost much, much more than what the Sanders campaign had said itself. And I think also Ken Thorpe, an economist at the at Emory University, who has worked in Democratic administrations, issued a similar report. So I am very curious to watch how liberal think tanks react to these different policies in the Senate, what kind of objections they raise, what kind of suggestions they offer, and if in a few months, when we've gotten through this moment, you know, which is really just this fall, open enrollment for Obamacare starts November 1st, so we're talking about the next 2 months or so when there's really time to make changes, whether if in early 2018 you see a pivot towards some kind of universal coverage system and white papers on that, or if you see a lot of white papers about here's how to fill the bare counties and like here's why we should raise the Obamacare subsidies from 400% of the poverty line to 500% of the poverty line. I think that will be quite telling about how far Democrats want to go on the healthcare issue.
I just think fundamentally, if your tweaks or whatever, your Obamacare fixes, if they're going to leave people with the bear counties is obviously an acute problem, but the single insurer counties strikes me as like a conceptually deep problem because there's so many of them, right? And it's in effect a single payer health insurance system, but like with this for-profit cutout standing in the middle. And like if people have tweaks that can actually fix that, like to me, like that's great and is like really worth talking about, right? Like make the system, not just like make the system not fail catastrophically, but make the idea of choice between private insurance plans actually a reality. You know, that sounds great and definitely worth talking about. Advantages of it in terms of being less disruptive and so on and so forth are really great and real. Trump is president. That obviously limits what you can do. But it's like if the final vision is that you're going to create a system for people who are under 65, over 133% of the poverty line, for whatever reason, don't get employer-provided health insurance, in which they have a subsidy to buy insurance from one private company, where that one private company will sometimes say it's going to pull out of the county to try to get a better deal, or maybe some other insurance company will sweep in at the last minute. Like, that's not a good idea. Like, I don't think anybody sincerely thinks that that's a good idea. And if it's not a good idea, you got to work on something like on a better idea, you know? I mean, part of the power of these Medicaid buy-in bills has been that I think people discovered that despite the at times condescending attitude of like political elites toward Medicaid, that people who get Medicaid seem fairly enthusiastic about it. They really appreciate the lack of cost sharing and so on and so forth. And that's like, you know, that's what you want from a program, right? It's like something people like. And it's difficult for me to imagine this kind of like one insurer kind of like wait by with your web browser refreshing to like see if it's going to be there next year kind of dynamic. Like it's journalistically exciting. Like we have these maps that we can fill in as like the counties go. But like that's no way to live your life, right? Like you would not be obtaining the psychological value of health insurance from that kind of system, it seems to me. And, you know, if it can be addressed inside that framework, like, go for it. But people don't even quite seem to be thinking, like, that big about their small fixes, which it seems like a problem to me.
Yeah.
Positive imagination.
Although I will say, I think sometimes you see kind of the weirder, more outside-the-box solutions coming from people who aren't seasoned health policy wonks. Like, this Nevada Medicaid buy-in, you know, came from a state legislator who emailed us afterwards and said he listened to our podcast and he heard how much people in Kentucky like Medicaid. And he thought, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if everyone in Nevada could buy Medicaid? It is hard for me. And now this idea is like getting analysis, getting traction, coming up in the Senate. It is hard for me to imagine, you know, some meeting at a liberal think tank where I think something like this could get shot down a little bit quicker when, you know, there'd be objections raised. No one's ever done this before. The Medicaid rules don't allow it, so on and so forth. Whereas when you have kind of one guy who says, hey, I think this is an interesting idea, I'll sponsor a bill on it. you end up with some weirder, more interesting approaches, even if they are not as fleshed out. So I think there is, I still feel like we are early enough in the Trump administration where there is space for vaguer outlines that can be filled in later.
And this is the last week of National Make-A-Will Month at LegalZoom, and that means that now is the time to take control of your family and your assets. Preparing for your family's futures is one of the most important things you can do in your life. It's probably the most important thing that you're going to do this summer. There's a lot to think about, but LegalZoom has an estate planning kit that's going to get you going. This is the kind of thing that I think most of us, you know we ought to do it, but it's a little uncomfortable to think about, and the logistical barriers to getting your legal situation in check often seem really daunting, but that's why LegalZoom is so great. You go to LegalZoom.com/prepare, you get your free kit. You will get a ton of helpful information, plus LegalZoom discounts, all the stuff you're going to need to stop procrastinating and start preparing for your family's future. LegalZoom designed this kit to provide the tools you need all in one place. Whether a trust or a will is right for you, you'll get a special LegalZoom discount, plus an estate plan checklist, an ebook, and other information to help you decide. And you can always get advice from LegalZoom's nationwide network of independent attorneys without being billed by the hour, since LegalZoom is not a law firm. So there's only a few days left in National Make-A-Will Month, so hurry to LegalZoom.com/prepare right now. There's no obligation, just great resources to help you take care of everything you care about. That's LegalZoom.com/prepare. Great news for anyone who's ever wanted to see our show in person. We are bringing the Weeds to the Now Hear This podcast festival in New York City in September. The festival is an amazing value. One ticket gets you access to all 25 live shows throughout the weekend. Go to nowhearthisfest.com to get your tickets. Enter promo code Weeds for $20 off. That's nowhearthisfest.com, promo code Weeds. Speaking of vague. No, I don't know.
No, this isn't vague.
We're just going to hard transition.
We're just going to transition right into that white paper.
We're going to talk about little kids in kindergarten.
Talk about kindergarten.
So here's a paper by, there was like too many authors on this paper. Elizabeth Dewey, Christoph Carbonic, David Filio, and Jeffrey Roth. And they looked at a question that I know has sort of occupies a lot of parents' minds. And it's the fact that, you know, typically if your kid's born in August, he could start kindergarten, you know, right after his birthday, right? And is a very newly minted 5-year-old and is off to kindergarten. Whereas if he's born in September, then he can't, you know, sort of retroactively get in, and a year later comes as a sort of 5 and 11 months old into kindergarten. And if you know little kids, you know, for grown-ups, like 1 year, who cares? For kids of that age, there's a big observable difference between, you know, someone who is 5 years and 1 month and someone who is 5 years and 10 months. And I happen to know that a lot of affluent parents in that situation tend to like hold their kids back. It's called redshirting for kindergarten. And if they were born in September, and, you know, sort of enroll them as a super old kindergarten starter rather than push them in early. I've always kind of wondered about this. So these researchers looked at a sort of big data set from Florida schools, and they show that the concern that parents of September kids have is not misguided, that kids born in August do a lot better than kids who are born in September. There's I shouldn't say it's not that huge, in fact, but it's 0.2 standard deviations. That's a pretty big effect, and that it's very stable. And interestingly, it persists over time, right? Like, typically when I hear parents say this, like me with my smarty pants hat on, is like, who cares? Like, this is going to be an issue in kindergarten. But like, by the time they're grown up, no one is like, aha, I was underprepared for kindergarten. The research here suggests that at least up through 15, that like the problems that arise from having been underprepared for kindergarten do indeed persist.
Well, they looked even farther, right? They looked at their likelihood to attend college. And it was a small difference, but it also showed up that the September-born children who start school when they're older are slightly, I think it was like 2% more likely to go to college. Slightly less likely to end up in juvenile detention.
Yeah, so it has persistent effects into adulthood. if you read Malcolm Gladwell's book, he talks about this in terms of hockey cohorts in Canada, and it's kind of like, ha, 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 because who cares about pro hockey players? But it turns out to be true for college attendance and even going to jail. It's kind of a bummer of a paper, in my opinion.
Well, and one of the things that's surprising is they find, because like you said, a lot of the redshirting happens among more affluent families who might be more aware of the issue, who might have the means to pay for another year of childcare.
Yeah, it's because if you're, I mean, it's like free school is like a really good benefit. I myself am really looking forward to being able to enroll Jose in some
free
school.
There'll be no redshirting. He's going right in.
Soon, we've got pre-K for three-year-olds in D.C.
Well, this made me feel, in Canada, we divide the year at January, and I'm a January right. kid, so I guess I shouldn't be. I was the oldest in my class, so I felt pretty good
about myself. You were redshirted.
Yes, I was redshirted, and I'm the beneficiary. Yeah. Now I host an illustrious policy podcast,
exactly.
So clearly it worked out very well. But one of the things I thought was interesting is they find that they're actually, even though this is a practice among affluent families, that it gets a bit counterbalanced by kids getting held back, essentially getting, you know, they keep, what are they, grade retention, is what they, which I thought was, it took me a while to understand what this euphemism was, and it was, they call it early grade retention, which essentially seems to be just being held back a grade. So they find that you start seeing the same thing, where kids who are not performing as well, not doing as well on testing, get held back a year, which is essentially a school version of redshirting.
Yeah, it's like redshirting first graders, rather than
kindergartners. So you see some of that, but I thought it was interesting, you know, they describe it as kind of like remarkable stability among really different groups of people, that because you have this intervention on the school side and intervention on the parent side, that it's not a place where, you know, rich kids are getting ahead because their parents are redshirting them. That actually, and I'm sure I've never been held back a grade, but I'm sure it kind of sucks to be held back a grade. It sounds like they are actually benefiting some of these kids who, you know, started much younger than their cohort. But it seems like a hard problem to solve, right? Like, unless you're doing, like, month-by-month starts on kindergarten, I don't quite know.
But to be clear, the parenting advice here is easy, right? Yes. You should not redshirt. Save yourself the money, and then the school will hold your kid back a year. And in particular, if the school wants to hold your kid back a year, swallow your pride.
Right, don't protest
and just let them do it. Right, that like it's good. That's the reassuring part, is that the school officials appear to be effective at identifying children who will benefit from being held back a year, right? And so if you just do nothing, right, if you don't redshirt, you don't complain if they get held back, it remediates the problem about as well as redshirting will, and it's cheaper. So like that's like,
take the free daycare.
That's like your fix as a parent. But as a policy problem, I don't know, man. I mean, what you could do. So my son is going into a private pre-K program for two-year-olds, because we have public pre-K for three-year-olds, but not for younger, starting this fall. And they divide the grades up in just more fine-grained way than based on whole calendar years. I think the age grouping is based on six-month clusters. So you still have some discontinuity around that. But conceivably, you know, you could do something like that, right? Instead of having a 12-month gap, have six-month gaps, at least in big cities where you have relatively large populations of children or dense suburbs even. In, you know, small towns, there's probably not enough children to do that kind of thing, although they often have grade merging anyway in smaller school districts. You know, so that might do some good. It's also, I think, bizarre that there's so little public pre-K just coming earlier. I don't know how much that would address this problem, but you can see the like financial strain that less affluent families are. They need that kindergarten as soon as they can possibly get it, which turns out to be okay in this case, but it's like, why not provide that service to people sooner?
And possibly desegregate it like from the traditional grade year in some sort of way. Like when you're, I don't know how, you probably know more about this because you have a kid, but like when your kid turns two, then they can enroll. Or I don't know if that's how the one works with the three-year-olds here, but it sounds okay. It sounds like that could get kids on slightly easier, on slightly more equal footing if it's kind of like you turn three and that's the month you can enroll in pre-K. But I imagine that's like a huge administrative mess, having kids coming in at new times, having like this constant churn in a classroom. And I think it's just hard because school policy, it's very local, but it's also somewhat national. Like, kids move from big cities to small town. And, like, how do you absorb a kid who's in, like, grade 3.25 into, like, a school system that has, like, grade merging and grades 3 and 4? Like, that just, you could do it in a big city, but I don't know if, I guess I don't know how much that policy makes sense on a local level, given that all these school districts end up somewhat intertwined.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess abstracting away from the logistical particulars, right? It this really seems like a thing where you step back, you'd be like, okay, we think that it is a good idea for people to have children. And, you know, I guess within some bounds of reason, but in general, like, you know, everybody claps on Mother's Day and stuff like that. And we also think it's good for children to be, like, educated. And we generally think it's appropriate for mothers to be participating in the labor force, is the sort of norms of our society. So there ought to be a fairly comprehensive solution for that, you know, starting not with 5-year-olds, but with at least, like, 1-year-olds, where there's, like, something. I mean, you could call it daycare, you call it preschool, I mean, you call it whatever you want. But, you know, early in the pipeline, where clearly you would have to differentiate pretty fine-grained way. I mean, nobody thinks it would make sense to lump 12-month-olds and 23-month-olds in the exact same, you know, curriculum or lesson plan. It would obviously not work. But it's that if you, like, start the pipeline appropriately early, at least of providing the services to people, then you start, you know, thinking this through. But instead, we have an education system that was kind of, like, built out from the elementary school level, which, you know, it has its historical reasons for it. But that's not how, you know, modern human society kind of works, where, like, the where we don't really need services for little kids. And everybody has a program, you know, something. Even fucking Donald Trump has some kind of thing to address the childcare needs of parents of young children. I mean, I don't think his proposal makes any kind of sense. But once we've acknowledged that, like, we are not just indifferent as a society to what's up with 2-year-olds, I think it starts to seem, like, more and more compelling to, like, press this in earlier, and then you can at least handle the age stuff in some kind of different way.
And I wonder, there might be research on this that I don't know about, but if when you have more of that kind of support system early, whether you see some of those gaps disappearing. Obviously, like you said, a 5-year-old and a five-year-old with 11 more months are very different developmentally. But I think I'm curious if you had a standardized program leading into kindergarten, if that gets rid of some of the incentive to redshirt. It'd be a little weird to redshirt if your kid, like, I guess you could leave them in pre-K for another year is how you do it, but I don't even know if the rules allow those sort of things.
I mean, maybe
it makes it a less common practice, and then you kind of leave it.
I guess would call that grade retention.
Yes, you know, some early, well, then you kind of leave it to the school, right? To decide if you are making the redshirting practice, because I think redshirting kind of feels more natural when your kid's at home, like, they're not in a program already, they're just kind of doing the same thing versus, like, pulling them back out of it for a year and back in. Then you could just rely on the early grade retention policies of your local school district.
Anyway, with that, thank you for listening. Parents, thanks for taking our kindergarten advice super seriously. I know this is where people go for all of their parenting advice and or state legislative ideas. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks to our producer, Peter Leonard, and to our sponsors. And we will see you on Friday with another amazing episode.
Woo!